Good day, and welcome to the Heritage Wealth Advisors first quarter 2020 market outlook conference call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a Q&A session at the end of the prepared remarks, and at that time, instructions will be given on how to ask a question. I'll now turn the call over to your host, Jay Jordan, Heritage Wealth Advisors Chief Investment Officer. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and a belated Happy New Year. Welcome to our first quarter 2020 market outlook call. For those of you that would like to follow along, there is a slide deck that's available on our website in support of the call that we will reference from time to time. If you go to www.heritagewealth.net, click on resources in the top right corner, and then news and updates, you will find the investment management tab. There you can find the slides. A replay of the call will also be available on the website following the call later this afternoon. I'm joined on the call today by two members of our investment team, Kerry Baronian and Dennis Song, as well as Chase Hill. Our agenda this morning is to review recent market performance, to discuss our current views on the economy and markets, provide insights on current portfolio positioning, and then we're going to pivot to a review of some new legislation which has important implications for all of us. I plan to provide some high-level commentary before turning the call over to Dennis and Kerry. So 2019 market performance represented a fitting end to an exceptional decade of financial market performance where stocks returned over 13%, which is above the long-term average of roughly 10%. Financial markets for the year were broadly higher, led by the S&P 500, which was up 31%, while fixed income markets generated high single-digit returns. But you can see the spectrum of returns on the second slide of the deck. Multiple expansion was the primary driver of growth as a combination of easing trade tensions and continued accommodative monetary policy boosted investor sentiment. As we look to 2020, the setup remains constructive with signs of a pickup in global economic growth, coupled with easing financial conditions supportive of equity markets. However, we recognize that domestic markets will be increasingly dependent on earnings growth given the recent multiple expansion, while positive sentiment does suggest the potential for a near-term pause given the recent steady appreciation of stocks over the month of December and early January. International markets appear poised to benefit, however, from more attractive valuations and an improving earnings outlook. So to get into more detail on our outlook, I'm going to turn the call over to Kerry Baronian.
Thanks, Jay. As we've discussed in previous communications, global financial conditions eased meaningfully last year as the Fed and other central banks around the world cut interest rates to try to stabilize growth. History suggests that these easing financial conditions should provide a tailwind to global growth, as shown by the left-hand chart on page 3 of the slides. Turning to the chart on the right-hand side of the page, we can see that this dynamic is beginning to play out, with leading economic indicators appearing to have reached a positive inflection point, while the diffusion index is rising, which signals that an increasing share of major economies are improving. While the pace of easing may slow, we believe that monetary policy will remain accommodative, given that inflation still resides below target in most major economies. With respect to fiscal policy, we expect existing stimulus in the U.S. to remain in place, but don't anticipate new initiatives in the near term. Congress is known for accomplishing less in presidential election years, and we believe that Trump's impeachment further reduces the likelihood of any substantive law being passed. Overseas, China continues to implement fiscal stimulus, including tax cuts, issuance of local government bonds to finance infrastructure projects, as well as fixed asset investment among state-owned enterprises. Additionally, France and other members of the Eurozone are enacting stimulus. As we've discussed in previous communications, the primary driver of weaker global growth last year was the slowdown in manufacturing activity. The slowdown actually began in early 2018, before trade tensions between the U.S. and China really escalated, although the trade tensions definitely exacerbated the slowdown. Today, global manufacturing activity may be bottoming, as shown by the left-hand chart on page 4 of the slides. Turning to the chart on the right-hand side of the page, we can see that global manufacturing activity tend to follow tends to follow fairly predictable 36-month inventory cycles. And the ratio of new orders to inventory is rising, which typically precedes a reacceleration or an acceleration in manufacturing activity. This is logical because the pace of new orders can't outstrip the pace of inventory production forever. Eventually, restocking is necessary. Additionally, the recent positive developments in trade between the U.S. and China should provide support to global growth. Phase one of a trade deal is scheduled to be signed tomorrow, and while all of the specifics aren't known yet, it's expected to reduce U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods and boost Chinese purchases of U.S. farm, energy, and manufactured goods. Trade policy uncertainty is receding, and the decline in business sentiment appears to be reversing trend, as shown by the charts on page 5. Now, you might be wanting to ask, well, should we really put stock in the latest batch of trade news? It's a reasonable question, and we believe that the answer is yes, as we see more incentive for both sides to reach a deal than escalate tensions over the coming year. From Trump's perspective, we think that his reelection campaign will drive his policy agenda. While he's polling well among Republicans, his overall approval rating is pretty low compared to other presidents at this stage of his term. Ironically, the manufacturing workers in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the voters who won him the election last go-round, are suffering disproportionately from the economic uncertainty that his trade policy generated. Average weekly earnings in those states are now running well below the national average. So the pragmatic approach would be to stop throwing fuel on the fire and work to revive sentiment in those states. Then from China's perspective, we believe that weak, albeit improving, growth really argues against risking another negative economic shock from a decline in exports. Additionally, while China may have contempt for Trump, there's no guarantee that a Democratic president would be an easier opponent, especially when all of the candidates are very focused on addressing climate change and human rights. Switching gears and looking at the U.S. economy, we believe that it remains on solid footing. According to their latest model, the Federal Reserve is forecasting U.S. real GDP growth of 2% for 2020. That's in line with the average pace of growth during this expansion. More specifically, the consumer, which represents approximately 70% of the total U.S. economy, continues to exhibit positive fundamentals. The unemployment rate remains low and average hourly earnings continue to increase, as shown by the chart on page 6. Additionally, consumer balance sheets remain healthy and the savings rate remains elevated, all of which should continue to support consumer spending. Furthermore, aside from the consumer, the housing industry continues to recover. Vacancy rates remain low and residential construction is quite strong, with home builder sentiment recently reaching a 20-year high. Overseas, the strength of China's economy has important implications for global growth. Chinese authorities have implemented more than 110 acts of credit and fiscal stimulus since 2018 to try to stabilize growth. As a result of these efforts, China's credit and fiscal impulse reached a positive inflection point last year, which history suggests should provide a tailwind to global growth. This dynamic is shown on page 7. A stabilization in global growth should result in stronger corporate earnings growth, as shown by the chart on page 8. With that, I'll turn the call over to Dennis to discuss the potential risks to our market outlook, as well as our views around asset allocation along with portfolio positioning.
Great. Thanks, Carrie. Appreciate that. Want to spend a few minutes talking about the current equity valuations as well as the risk factors that we see in 2020. As Jay mentioned, equity market performance was quite strong in 2019, with the S&P appreciating 31%. What we're seeing with fourth quarter earnings starting today is that the current consensus is looking for full year 2019 earnings to grow around 4%. As Jay mentioned, most of the appreciation was really a function of multiple expansion, which you'll see on page 9. We started a year with the S&P forward earnings at around 14 times, relatively attractive, and we ended the year at around 18 times. And the reasons for that was what Kerry mentioned, a supportive Fed, some resolution to the trade policy, as well as a less likelihood of a hard Brexit, and most recently a quick flare-up in the U.S.-Iranian relationships and appears to be a quick resolution. And in the context of historical multiples, you know, 18 times is on the higher side of the medium, but not an extreme. And looking at international multiples of international markets, you know, 14 times we feel like is actually relatively reasonable and looks relatively attractive to the U.S. And I'll talk about some of the movements that we're making in the portfolio in a second. Turning to the right-hand side of the page, you've seen this chart before. It's basically depicting what a equity holder is getting compensated for owning equities. It's the equity risk premium over the risk-free rate. And as you can see, for U.S. equities, right now you're being paid around 5 percentage points over the risk-free rate for owning equities domestically and around 7 percentage points for international equities. So I think the takeaway combining, you know, historical valuations in where risk-free rates stand today and, you know, what we're looking for in terms of S&P earnings growth in 2020, which, by the way, is around 8% this year. You know, assuming kind of flattish multiple, we still see equity markets returning in the, you know, mid to high single digit area, assuming no multiple expansion and if the economic base case plays out. Just turning the page to the fixed income markets, you know, I think the quick takeaway here is that the fixed income markets still do not appear to be adequately compensating investors for both the duration and credit risk. On the top portion of the page, there's the yield curve from the December 31st, 2019. And what you'll see there is that the curve is upward sloping, although it's still relatively flat, especially in the context of historical standards. You have about 23 basis point pickup from the 5 years to the 10 year, and about another 40 basis points out to 30 years from the 10 years. And, you know, the nice thing here is that, you know, early in the summer we saw an inversion in the yield curve, which typically signal a economic slowdown and the Fed being too tight with respect to monetary policy. You know, subsequent to the Fed moves to decrease rates three times, the front end of the curve has moved down to about 1.5%, and we are seeing a re-steepening of the curve, which suggests, you know, a modest economic growth in the foreseeable future. And on the bottom chart, essentially shows high yield credit spreads and default rates, and you can see that, and both are tracking close to historically low levels. And given where we are in the cycle, we prefer to express credit risk through other avenues. Just turning to the risks that to our market outlook. I think the most predominant one that dominated headlines in 2019 was the trade war. And as Kerry mentioned, phase one of the deal with China is expected to be signed tomorrow. And we think this is likely to be the status quo until election. However, there's always the potential for phase two negotiations to start up, which will address some of the more challenging aspects of the relationship as to intellectual property theft. And if that were to happen, we could potentially see a re-escalation of the trade war. But I think the fact that we reached phase one and that we have removed China as a currency manipulator and have stepped back in tariffs, I think it's pretty clear Trump's intentions is to try to run on the phase one deal as an accomplishment. There is also potentially the risk of expanding the trade war to the European countries, but I think at this point the market is pricing a more manageable risk. Other geopolitical risk, obviously the U.S. election in November is a big one. I think the markets have been volatile, especially with respect to the healthcare stocks. But I think that the with the resurgent economy and Trump is looking relatively strong, we'll see. I think there needs to be some clarity on who the front runner, who the ultimate nominee is from the Democratic side before the market starts to repricing some of the risk. And again, I always want to mention, you know, campaign rhetoric versus the ability to actually pass bills and implement and change the entrenched interests there. So we'll continue to monitor the election situation, and perhaps you'll provide some opportunities. Other geopolitical risks are Iran and North Korea. Obviously, any destabilization in the Middle East that influences commodity prices, oil prices, could potentially affect our economy. So we'll continue to keep an eye on those risks. I think the biggest risk, frankly, is actually inflation. You know, as Kerry mentioned, the Fed has been supportive in 2019 and drove a lot of the liquidity into the markets. We think that's likely to continue. However, you know, the CPI was just reported this morning. In 2019, we're running about 2.3%, and wage inflation, given the tightness in employment markets, ran north of 3% for all of 2019. So there are inflationary pressures building within the economy. And if we see inflationary pressures pick up, the Fed may be constrained as to their ability to assist the markets and make sure that the expansion is prolonged. So with all that said, you know, combining the economic outlook and the market outlook, you know, let's talk about the portfolio a little bit. I think, you know, what a difference a year makes is probably the headline. You know, last year this time, the markets were in a very different place, and we were actively looking to upgrade and add equity exposure to our portfolios given the attractive risk-reward to the U.S. markets. We've had a really strong year, as discussed. The multiples are still in line with historical norms, but a little bit on the higher side. We do see more attractive opportunities internationally. As such, we are reducing our overweight to U.S. equities relative to international equities, and we've done that through a couple of ways. And one of them is to reduce the BlackRock Global Equity Dividend Fund, which has a pretty strong exposure to consumer defensives, healthcare stocks, which is half of the portfolio, in industrials. And we've shifted some of those funds to the Dodge & Cox International Fund that has a little bit more cyclical exposure through financials, technology, and healthcare, as well as a larger emerging market exposure. Secondly, we increased our exposure to emerging markets and really moved it from an underweight to a neutral exposure. And again, emerging markets is roughly 50-55% China and Southeast Asia related exposures. So we are, you know, that shift is consistent with kind of our thinking with respect to the trade war staying manageable for the foreseeable future. And, you know, overall, we're rebalancing our large cap exposures to target allocations for all kind of portfolios. And there's a lot going on in the research pipeline, and we look forward to updating you in the near future. So with that, I'll turn it back to Jay.
Great. So thanks, Dennis. So to summarize, you know, our base case remains that an improving economic outlook coupled with accommodative monetary policy should favor equities over fixed income alternatives. But we do remain mindful of the risk and to that view, and we've really positioned portfolios accordingly. We're now going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to have Chase Hill provide some thoughts on some recent legislation that has important planning implications.
Thanks, Jay. We want to take a few minutes at the end of today's call to update you on some significant tax legislation that passed at the end of the year. On December 20th, the President signed two spending appropriations bills. Included in this legislation was the Setting Up Every Community for Retirement Enhancement Act, more commonly known as the SECURE Act. The SECURE Act had passed the House overwhelmingly earlier in 2019, but it stalled in the Senate and appeared to be dead for the year until it was added to the spending bills at the last minute. The Act contains a number of provisions affecting retirement plans. First, the Act increases the beginning date for required minimum distributions from retirement plans from age 70 and a half to age 72. It is important to note that this change goes into effect for account holders who turn 70 and a half after December 31st, 2019. For anyone who had already reached age 70 and a half prior to the end of the year, the Act does not change the required distribution schedule or rules. One immediate question we had was whether this would have any impact to those taking advantage of the qualified charitable distribution rule. The Act does not change this rule, which allows IRA account holders age 70 and a half or older to distribute up to $100,000 per year from the IRA to charity. The second major change, which is getting most of the headlines, was the elimination of the stretch provision for account beneficiaries. The stretch provision allowed designated beneficiaries to stretch required minimum distributions from inherited plans over their lifetimes. Under the new rules, most non-spousal beneficiaries will now be required to distribute the funds within 10 years following the death of the original account holder. It's interesting to point out that while the beneficiary is required to empty the account within the 10-year period, there are no minimum annual distribution requirements during those 10 years. So while the elimination of the stretch may not be good news for most, there may actually be more flexibility for planning those distributions during the first 10 years, and it will be heavily dependent on the beneficiary's individual tax situation. There are a few exceptions to the 10-year rule for a class known as eligible designated beneficiaries, which include spouses, disabled or chronically ill beneficiaries, beneficiaries who are less than 10 years younger than the original account holder, and minor children. In the case of minor children, the 10-year rule eventually will kick in once the child reaches the age of majority. We should note that these rules also impact Roth IRAs. However, given the potential future income tax burden for beneficiaries, we suspect more clients will want to take a look at Roth conversions as a way to mitigate that future tax. Biggest takeaway from the stretch change is it's important for all account holders to review their beneficiary designations along with their estate plans. In addition to those two major provisions, the SECURE Act also included a number of other provisions, including a new exception to the 10% early withdrawal penalty for childbirth or adoption. This exception allows a penalty-free withdrawal up to $5,000 per child. In addition, traditional IRA contributions are now allowed for taxpayers over the age of 70 and a half who were previously not allowed to contribute once they reached that age. There were a number of new provisions added for 401k plans, making it easier for plan sponsors to offer annuity options. And additional incentives were introduced to encourage small employers to adopt retirement plans. Along with the SECURE Act, the Appropriations Bill also included the 2019 version of the Tax Extenders Bill. Probably the most notable for our clients is that the hurdle rate for itemized medical deductions was reduced back to 7.5% of adjusted gross income. The hurdle rate had been scheduled to increase from 7.5% to 10% for 2019 and later years, but now has been reduced back to 7.5% for 2019 and 2020. We should note that the extenders is only effective for through the end of 2020. So once again, we'll be watching at the end of this year to see if Congress will act to extend measures beyond this year. Of course, we'll continue to keep a close eye for additional changes and be working with our clients over the coming months to assess the impact of this recent legislation to their individual situations. And with that, I'll turn the call back over to Jay.
Great. Okay, so this concludes our prepared remarks. We're now going to turn it over to the operator for Q&A.
And at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Star and one on your touchtone phone. If you find your question has been asked and answered, you can remove yourself by hitting the pound key. And we'll pause a few moments to allow questions to queue.
So while we're waiting for questions, I'm going to ask Dennis to respond to a question that was mailed in by one of our clients last night, which is that 5G is expected to have a meaningful impact on technology going forward. And I would be interested in your thoughts on the impact on 2020 and beyond, and whether there are less obvious areas to be affected other than telecommunications and autos and transportation.
Sure. Thanks, Jay. So, you know, to answer this question, I think it would be nice to give a quick background to what exactly is 5G and how it could potentially impact, how we live and act and consume media. So by way of background, if you think about the different generations of wireless technology, 1G is essentially voice. 2G was effectively the ability to get text. And 3G was getting data packets that allow you to get web pages on your BlackBerry devices, for those of you that still remember those. And then the 4G essentially is the streaming era, where capabilities were introduced that allow you to stream video data with some latency. And the fastest data, in terms of downloading in the 4G era, is about 2 gigabytes per second. Effectively, 5G technology is a technology that basically takes the speeds up by 10 times, the ability to download at 20 gigabytes with no latency. In fact, the latency would be faster than the actual human response, for instance, to typing. It is that type of technology that will potentially allow for driverless cars. If you think about the sensors that's needed in automobiles and how it's tracking the road and where it's going. So, with respect to how it's going to affect us in 2020 and beyond and some of the other areas, just to give you an idea, when 4G was introduced in 2010, it took a couple years before an app that actually really changed the way we consume media was introduced in 2012. And I would say that, the major carriers in the U.S. Plowed billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars into the 4G upgrade. And it's debatable whether or not the return on investment was worth it ultimately. Because if you think about how much deflation was happening with, in wireless rates, the return on capital of invested was okay, but it was not great. Hence why the U.S. is a little bit behind in 5Gs. Carriers continue to be disciplined in their CapEx deployment, but they know inevitably that this is something that's going to have to be deployed. So I think in the foreseeable future, in 2020 and 21, you're probably not going to see too much of a change. In fact, AT&T actually announced a decrease in CapEx from $21 billion to about $18 billion this year. But going forward, how 5G plays out is it's really about the Internet of Things, the ability to connect various devices within your home, your microwave, your refrigerator, your toaster, your HVAC system, and ultimately cars. And the way that it's transmitted is it's using a different spectrum that's a little smaller than the current 4G, which will require carriers to build multiple micro towers instead of these larger towers I see out there. So some of the other areas that are likely to be affected are towers, tower REITs, American Tower, Crown Castle, SBA Communications. Data centers is probably a less obvious area in terms of the amount of data that's going to be collected and stored. And obviously industrial REITs and retail companies as continue shift the e-commerce to e-commerce from the brick and mortar. So I'll just leave it at that.
Great. Thanks, Dennis. Operator, do we have any other questions?
There are no phone questions at this time.
Okay. Well, if we don't have any other questions, then we'd like to thank everybody for joining the call. As I mentioned earlier, there will be a copy of the call available on the website later this afternoon. And in the meantime, please don't hesitate to reach out to any additional questions to any member of our team. So thank you all for participating. I hope everybody has a great day.